you. My name's George. Not that high. My name's George and I'm a Ghanaian addict. I actually am, technically. I mean, I think I'm Ghanaian in the World Cup when Ghana are in it. They don't stay in it for that long. But then as soon as they get knocked out, I go back to being English again. So anyway, I was actually born in Ghana. I came to this country when I was 2.5. I have no memories of Ghana, but they must be in there somewhere. 2.5 years, and then I was uprooted from the land of my birth and plonked down in Cornwall in the winter time. Yeah, I know. I mean, I cried. I cried all the way from Ghana to Cornwall. I left my teddy bear behind me. And I cried, I know, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. I left my dad behind. I don't know whether I cried for him, but I was crying for the teddy bear. And we got back, we ended up in Cornwall, and when we got to Heathrow, my mum called my granny, she went out, bought me a teddy bear, I stopped crying. So, you know, it's just early abandonment. You know, I have no memory, but it must be in there. I was talking to my sister years ago, about 10 years ago now, and I was saying that I like to eat from a bowl with a spoon, and I have no idea why. And she said, I know why. They eat from bowls and spoons in Ghana. They don't use knives and forks and plates. And I thought, there you go. It's in there. You know, so that's an early abandonment, you know, leaving a hot, warm country and coming to a cold, cold country with white people. You know, my mother was white, and but I mean, it must have been quite weird, really, just coming back to, you know, this strange country. It's just bizarre. In Cornwall, we were the only black people in Cornwall at the time. And no, it's true. It was in the 60, 66, something like that. You know, no blacks in Cornwall, apart from us. And that's just how it was. That's just the way it was. You know, we were all, you were talking about freaks, yeah? We were the freaks. By default. You know, they just didn't do anything. We were just freaks. You know, we'd walk down the street and curtains would twitch. You know, because people, I mean, they're just fucking nosy there, aren't they? But they got nothing better to do but just look and see what's going on. You know, it's weird. The curtains would just twitch like that. And then sometimes, you know, people would just decide to shout at us, why don't you go back to your fucking mud huts and swinging through the jungle? And our mum would go, don't react. Don't do anything. So I learnt my lessons very well, very early. Don't react, freeze. Like that. You know, it's that, just freeze. Don't do anything. Just pretend it's not happening. And I can still do that today. If something kicks off, my reaction is to freeze. And I go in. And I don't do anything. I just sit there really quietly. And this is the thing about these early childhood stuff. It stays with you. You know, so I learned, don't react. Freeze. We never talked about it. Why are they telling us to go back to the fucking mud huts? I mean, we had stewards and houseboys. But, you know, to this country, it's like I had a bone in my nose, little pot belly, grass skirt and olden spear. That's what they thought. And it's just like, you know, you look at it and you go, what the fuck? This is what people think that I am. And there wasn't anything such as political correctness. No, that didn't exist. You know, we had mind your language. You know, we had, what was that one? What was that one now? Blimey, coons and sambos and all stuff like that. I've got it. You know, so this was how I was represented. It didn't make me feel great about myself. You know, so early rejection, come to Cornwall, only blacks in Cornwall, with the object of fun and ridicule, and I thought I was ugly. I thought that I was really ugly because I wasn't white. And I remember looking in the mirror one time, I don't know how old I was, and thinking, oh, my skin's a different colour than everyone else's. Oh, I don't like that. I want to be like everyone else. I want to be white, and I want to have blue eyes and blonde hair. It didn't fucking happen. And, you know, it's just sad, really, you know. It's just like... how you can learn to hate yourself at an early age with no one really telling you, but you just absorb. I think I must have been quite sensitive. You absorb the emotion that's given out to you. I mean, I didn't really know what fuck off back to my ruts and swinging through the jungle meant, but I knew it wasn't nice. I knew it was something wrong, and I thought I was wrong. And then my mum died when I was 9, and I thought that was my fault. I went to bed, woke up, she'd gone. Never saw her again. She died. She was, you know, she was really ill. But it's just like, I remember my counsellor one time, he said, you must have known your mum was ill. It's like, I didn't have a fucking clue, mate. She was always ill. You know, if you have a parent that's always ill, that's just the way it is. So she got a bit iller. Who cares? I didn't know. I didn't know she's going to die. Never entered into my head at 9 years old my mum was going to die. And then she's gone. Another rejection. And I was born into a religious cult. I didn't even know that it was a religious cult. I thought it was just a religion. Fucking hell, that did a good number on me. You know, it's just like... we were freaks. I was born into a religious cult. We didn't celebrate Christmas. And you can imagine, right, the only blacks in bloody Cornwall, and we go back to school after Christmas, and what did you get for Christmas? Oh, we don't keep Christmas. And everyone looked... you know, it's just like... oh, fucking hell, I just so wanted to be like everyone else. So then mum dies, and our cult thinks it's a nice idea that we go and live with a black family. It's like, what the fuck? You know, we've never mixed with black people. And they choose us a West Indian family, because all blacks are the same, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's a wrong fucking culture, mate. So there we are, plonked with this Jamaican family. And we were quite well brought up, you know, because our mum brought us up and she taught us manners and this and that and whatever. They hated us. Because I think we were what they wanted to be. You know, they aspired to this kind of like middle class. We weren't middle class, we were dirt fucking poor, but we talked well. I talked a lot better than I talk now. And, you know, the abuse started. You know, it started off quite nicely for the first couple of months, but then it's just like the gloss came off. And I remember the first time he beat me, Mr. Nash, I don't know what I did, but he said, go get up them stairs! And I went up the stairs and he got his belt off and he's put it in two and he's snapping it like that, right? Bang, bang. And he said, you know, take your fucking trousers down and I'm going to beat you. And if you cry, I'm going to beat you even more. And I was beaten on my lower back with the buckle end of the belt and I didn't cry. And if that happens to you, your mind has to go somewhere else. In order not to cry, you have to splinter yourself off somehow, because you can't stay in your body, because you'd cry. And I knew if he beat me and I cried, I'd get beaten even more. So I had to splinter myself off to keep myself safe. You know, perhaps my mum's early messages, freeze, don't react, was quite helpful. Because I could freeze, not react, splinter myself. And then, you know, that's how I learnt to disassociate. And then after that beating, it's get downstairs and it's like it never happened. And, you know, you start to doubt your sanity when things like that happen. You kind of like... Is this kind of real? What's happening? Because it seemed real, but no one's talking about it. And I'm meant to carry on like it's never happened. So I carry on like it's never happened. Don't react. Just carry on. Ignore it. And inside I'm going, I don't know how to deal with this. I really don't know how to deal with what's happening. My mum's dead. I'm living with this family. He's beating me. And I have to pretend none of it's happening. And this is the God that made all that happen. And it's just like, well, I don't want anything to do with that God. And then I remember one time, I think I licked my knife. And he said to me, you don't deserve to eat like a person if you have no manners. And he made me go in the garden and eat from a dog bowl. It's bizarre and twisted. And I thought it was my fault. You see, this is the thing. At each stage, I thought it was my fault. Well, I must be bad to be beaten like that. I must be bad to be treated like that. And that made me feel that I was even more ugly. Because as a child, I put bad and ugly together. We get given messages. You know, Disney does it really nicely. The wicked stepmother, you know, the witch. The bad people are always ugly. So I learned that if I'm bad, I must be ugly. And then at 13, I went to live in a children's home. It's like, fucking hell, even my foster parents don't want me now. And so I go and live in a children's home because no one wants me. Well, I must be really bad then. If these nasty people don't want me. And I've come to realise that actually this turning myself ugly was quite normal. You know, my damage was so strong that I had to manifest my damage onto myself. So when I looked in the mirror, I had the physical manifestation of that damage. Ugly. When I say ugly, I don't mean plain. I mean butt fucking the ugly. You know, this is the truth. It's just like if I could say, oh, I was just a bit plain, that'd be lovely. I mean disfigured ugly. You know, and I really thought that I was disfiguredly ugly. And when I was 18, I started going out clubbing and things. And people said to me, but you're beautiful. And I was like, nah, I don't think so. And I say, no, I'm not. And they say, but you are. And I say, no, you don't understand, I'm not. And it was just like, it couldn't meet. You know, they'd say, but you must know that you are. And I would go, but you must know that I'm not. Because how can something so disfigured and ugly be beautiful? And, you know, I was grateful that people wanted to have sex with me. All you had to do is fucking ask. But it's true! You know, it's just like, what, you want to have sex with me? Fucking hell, I'm made up. Thank you very much for asking. It's just like, I thought that they would taking pity on me. You know, I started having sex with adult men when I was 13. I didn't see anything wrong with it at the time. It was exciting, it was fun, I fucking loved it. But that's abuse. That's abusive. I was desperate for love. And I had abuse, and I thought it was love. And my drug use, I started off at 13. It all kicked off at 13. Sex, bulimia, drugs. And with the eruption of hormones, I just hated myself even more. You know, the hormones made me fucking crazy. And I was born in this religious cult. Having sex with men at 13, there's only one place I'm ending up, that's hell. You know, so I absolutely hated myself. I had to take drugs to cope with what I felt about my life. If I hadn't had drugs, I wouldn't be sitting here now. I'd be dead long time ago. So, you know, taking drugs kept me alive. Killed me slowly on a daily fucking basis, but it kept me alive until I could stop taking drugs and actually really want to learn how to live. And people tried telling me in my early 20s, George, it doesn't have to be like that. It's like, fuck off, what do you know? You know, these well-meaning people. You know, but it's true, you know, well-meaning people. You don't have to do that. Of course I fucking have to do it. How am I meant to live with this stuff that I have inside of me? No one showed me that. How am I meant to live with hating myself? With the memories that I killed my mum, I didn't kill my mum, but, you know, I killed my mother, that I deserved to be fucking made to eat out of a dog bowl, that I was beaten and called names as a child because I was different than everyone. How am I meant to live with all of that? What, on a cup of tea? So, you know, drugs came in very handy. They helped me. They kept me alive. And I remember when I was about 30, 31, you know, I'm not going to talk about my using, because my using was just boring, really. No, it was. I'd love to say it as glamorous. And as, I mean, a couple of times it was. I remember 5 o'clock in the morning jumping into Hackney Canal and having a snog with this gorgeous fucking geezer. You know, that's quite fun. But I mean, it's just like most... No, but I mean, there has to be a few moments like that. You know, when you just get it all right and the sun's coming up and you go... You're drug fucked, yeah? But you go, oh, this is amazing. You know, so there were moments like that. Of course there were. Few and far between. In the end, right, there weren't any moments like that. You know, I remember when I first started using drugs, we'd giggle and laugh and this. That fucking went by. You know, all I was doing in the end is using and hating and resenting myself. And I went out with this guy. He was 7 years clean. Oh, bless his little fucking heart. 7 years clean, and he's going out with me. And we'd go to parties, and people would go, you're really nice to him. Right? And he'd go, thank you, I am, aren't I? And I'd be like, what? You can't say that. And he actually meant, thank you for noticing that I'm really nice. I agree with you, I am really nice. And I'd be like, what the fuck? Because people say, you're really nice, George. And I go, oh, thanks. If you knew what I've been doing last night, you wouldn't think that. So I didn't think that. But I could see that he really thought that. And the thing is, right, his father used to sexually abuse him as a child. And it blew me away that he could sit there and go, I'm really nice. And I could, with all my glittering, fucking, wonderful, fragile facade, right, I hated myself. And I wanted a bit of what he had. And it's just like, well, and he'd sit down and talk to me and stuff like that. And I remember one time just after Christmas, this is before I came into recovery, it's like the 28th when I decided that actually I can't do this anymore, I need to change. So I chucked away my drugs, I chucked away my cigarettes, and I was just like, twiddling my thumbs, you know. And I don't know how long I lasted, but I didn't last very long. And I thought, I can't fucking do this, this is like, you know when you feel that you want to rip your fucking skin off, right, because you can't bear that feeling inside of you. And I thought, I can't do this. Oh, I can't do this. So I thought, well, what can I do then? And I thought, well, I'll just not drink, because actually alcohol's a problem. So I didn't drink. Didn't drink for about a year and a half. just took more drugs. And then a year and a half later, I realised, fuck me, I'm just taking more drugs. I'm just taking drugs like the way I drank. Something's got to happen. And I went to my first NA meeting, the 20th of September, 1999. I've been coming back ever since. Thank you. I'm 17 and a half years clean. And I didn't go to rehab. I mean, I wish I had. Could have done with a nice little bit of rehab, you know what I mean? But I just... Actually, I don't think I could have done with a nice little bit of rehab, truthfully told, because it's like you don't get a feeling at me. How are you feeling, George? Fine. How are you really feeling? Fine. Anything else going on? No, I'm fine. And it's just like, yeah, fine. You want to go there? Go there, because I'm fine. And so rehab wouldn't have worked. It's just like, I was so frozen. I didn't have feelings. I was taught not to have feelings. When you get beaten and splintered and stuff like that, you don't have feelings. So I didn't do rehab. I just came to the rooms, hated it, slunk in like a beaten dog. You know, you see these abused dogs, like, and their tails right wrapped between their legs, protecting their bollocks. That's how I came into the room. That is true. Broken and beaten. And, you know, I walked into this, not this meeting, but I walked into my first meeting and I heard people laughing. I was like, eh? And I walked in and they're all having cups of tea and biscuits and talking about what's on TV. And I thought, what the fuck's going on? And someone came and talked to me. I ignored her because I didn't know how to talk to people. Penelope said, you're doing the 40-minute chair. That's all right, isn't it, George? You can just talk for England. Well, I can now when I'm English. You know, but, I mean, back at the time, I couldn't talk. I couldn't open my fucking mouth and talk because I was too frozen with fear. And I sat there and I heard this meeting and I heard people talking about feelings, about hating themselves, about no self-worth, about abuse. And I was just like, what? That blew me away. And actually, the truth is, if you really want to know, right, I don't remember much about it. All I did was sit there in the circle, looking at the geezer's legs in front of me, thinking, he's got a nice packet, innit? Kept me coming back. And what happened was, right, as I kept on coming back, these geezers were... Because it's quite frightening going to meetings in North London, like a little black gay man going to meetings in North London and talking about your boyfriend. My palms would be sweating, my heart would be beating, and I'd be thinking, fuck me, I can't talk about this. Make myself talk about it, right? And I'd come back next week and they'd go, hey, how's your fucking boyfriend, George? Come here. And I'd just be like, what? Come here, mate, come on. Hey, you fucking... And that's how I learned acceptance. You know, because they accepted, no, not all of them, some of them did that fucking shirt lifter and stuff, but, you know, yeah, but they will do. You know, I mean, we've got to understand, this is life. You know, so not everyone accepted me, but some of the people that I thought would judge me actually accepted me. And through that process, I learned to accept myself. Fucking hell, if these fucking geezers can accept me, why can't I accept myself? And I learned to look at those messages that I've been given. And I learned that slow thaw. I mean, I wasn't going to get a sponsor. I wasn't going to work the steps. It's just like, well, it might be all right for all you lot. I'm not doing it. And I wasn't going to. Until being clean was no longer enough. Clean... but crazy. And I saw people in recovery quite happy. And I wanted to be happy. And I, how did you get so happy? I just went the steps. Look at that. Just work the steps. Suppose I'll have to just work the steps, won't I? And actually, you know what? I mean, the thing is, right? I was... My self-worth and my self-esteem were so low and my ego was so big, and that's an awful combination. Huge ego, no self-worth. You just go at any given moment, you know what I mean? So I actually had to humble myself a little bit. And I wanted to get a sponsor, right? And I needed to get a sponsor that I didn't fancy. That I respected. Took me about a year to get my sponsor. Didn't fancy him, respected him. Still got him. All this time later, still got him. He said to me a few years ago, when I saw you, I was like, this is going to be fun. I don't know if it was fun for him. Sometimes it wasn't fun for me, but, you know, there you go. But I respected him enough to listen. And, you know, the thing is now, I mean, I've got sponsees, and some of my sponsees have got sponsees, and they say to me, how do I get them to say, you don't fucking get them to do anything. No one could get me to do something. I couldn't get my sponsees to do anything. They had to get themselves to do it. How do I get them? You don't. That's the whole point, you don't. You let them stew in their misery. But you do, you just let them stew in their misery. You've had enough yet? No, I think I'll keep going on. And you know, unfortunately, right? Listen, right? Some people, unfortunately, they go on to the bitter fucking end. Because they're so convinced they're fucking right. You know, but eventually, when they've had enough of pain, right, they might be willing to change. Then you can tell them what you did. After time, they still don't do it, but that's all right. Don't bother. I'm still going to sleep. No, it's true. It's just like, you've come and asked me, to be your sponsor, because I've got something that you want. What, and you think I can pass it on by osmosis? If I could, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. Because I've worked fucking hard to get what I've got. I've worked me bollocks off. Yeah? I worked really hard to get... So, if you want what I've got to offer, you work fucking hard and all. And it's not bloody easy. Let me tell you this. If you think every fucking day of my 17 and a half years I've been tripping down the light fantastic... I haven't. Isn't it, Gary? I see you nodding, yeah? No, but it's true, isn't it? It's fucking hard. That's why the more, it's like a bloody pyramid, the longer you get in recovery, the less people stand up at the fucking London Convention. Right? One thing that I haven't done in my 17 and a half years is use. I've done it all. Lied, cheated, shoplifted, been unfaithful, stolen from work. Done it all. Not use. And I've had to deal with the consequences of that. That's why now I can't be fucking bothered. Mm-hmm. Penelope said, oh, have you been doing the share that you've meant to be doing and then the share that you think you're going to do? And I said, no, I haven't actually, oddly enough, Penelope. I don't know what I'm going to say. She said, oh, it's the second surrender. I was just like, I don't know what it is, but I just can't be fucking arsed anymore. No, it's true, right? When I came into recovery, I loved drama. Chaos. Mayhem. I mean, I caused enough of it. So I came in and I just did the same thing. Caused more chaos and mayhem. What I had to learn, a little bit of serenity is quite nice. A little bit of peace and calm is really quite nice. And you know the nice thing about it? Don't have to make amends. Fucking hell, I remember in a meeting, right, owning the fact that I'd lied about having a son. I had pictures of this non-existent son and everything. And then it's just like, oh. I almost convinced myself I had one. No, it's true. This is what my mind can fucking do, you know what I mean? It can take a couple of grains of something and spin it at the speed of light and it goes boof like candy floss, and I've made an alternate reality for myself. So the great thing is, like, being in recovery takes that candy floss and puts it back to the grains, right? And you know, I mean, I realise, actually, my life goes a lot easier when I don't fuck things up for myself, really. Because, actually, I don't like putting my hand up and going, oh, I've done it wrong. Ooh, got to tell you something. I don't like it. And, you know, and working a programme helps me not have to do that. It really does. You know, I have worked the steps once. I used to feel a big load of shame about that, hearing people, oh, I'm on my fifth step four. And I'd be going, well, my recovery must be shit then. And I was almost tempted to go, yeah, I've doing it for them. And I haven't. I've done them once. But I do work them constantly. I constantly work the steps. You know, someone said to me that I really like, they said, you work them this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, right? Then you put them that way and you zip up and down them as you go along. I'm like, yeah, I like that one. And actually working them means that I don't fuck things up so that I have to go back and work them again. You know, I've learned this old chestnut, God never gives you more than you can handle. No one told that to God, did they? I've had to learn, right, after working 75 hours a week. Actually, the most I ever worked in a week is 170-something hours. There's only 168 hours in the week. So I went to work on the Saturday, I stayed at work, and I went home the next Sunday. That's not sustainable. So I had to learn, right, to handle saying no. Now, for someone who's codependent, no, don't come easy. I'd find myself saying yes, right? When I should have said no. What the fuck am I saying yes for when I meant to say no? People will ask me stuff, I'd hear this yes come out of my mouth. And then I'd have to go and do it. And that'd make me resentful. And when I was resentful, I'd go and use. So I had to learn, actually, before I learned to say no, I learned to say, let me think about it. Because I couldn't say no, I was too frozen with fear that they might not like me. Let me think about it. And then I'd go and talk to my sponsor and my partner and this and that about how to say no. And then I'd say no. And actually, the odd thing is, people just accepted it. And it's like, well, where the fuck did all this fear come from then? In my crazy head. It was like I was raised on fear. And uncertainty and anxiety. And I knew that very well indeed. And I had to undo that. And you know, I was, what, 35 when I came into recovery? You got 35 years of shit to undo. It takes a bit of time. And I had to allow that time to happen. You know, now it's just like, I can say no. You coming out for fellowship? Nah. Because I don't like going out for fellowship. No, I don't. I'm avoidant, right? It's too loud. It's too fucking noisy. Everyone's crazy. I just want to go home. No, but it's true. And they go, oh, it'd be nice if you come, George. I'm like, yeah, I'm not coming. And they go, you'll come another time, won't you? And I go, yeah, I'll come another time. So I go out for fellowship about 4 times a year. Funny thing is, when I do it, I quite like it. And I go, what am I so resistant about? And it's all the same as going out to a party. I can't be bothered. Come on, George, let's go to the party. No one stay home. When I go to the party, I'm enjoying myself. But if I could have a teleportation device, right, that would get me from my flat to the party, I'd go. But it's just like, oh, I've got to get dressed, got to have a wash. And at my age, right, I've got to shave my fucking ears. Because I'm quite vain, right? Do the nose bit. Trim my fucking eyebrows. That's before I've had a shower. So sometimes it's just a lot easier to stay at home. But actually, when I do make the effort to do this stuff, I really enjoy socialising with people. I'm quite good at socialising. course I'm good at socialising. I'm an addict. I could milk the drugs out of your fucking pocket 50 metres upwind. I'm very good at socialising. You know, but actually what's now is I socialise because I want to. My life has changed completely. I was doing dead end, no hope, little tatty fucking jobs because I thought that I was a dead end, no hope, little tatty person. And in recovery, I've had to risk success. Yeah. I mean, I love it now, right? But at the time, it's like, what? It's too much to lose. See, the thing, my thing was, if I tried something, I would fail. Everyone would laugh at me, call me an idiot, so I ain't trying. Now I've had to risk success. This is what this program gives me. I'm not really talking much about the steps and stuff, but it's all down to this bloody program. You know, I can't live my life the way that I used to. That's not recovery. So because I come into recovery, if I'm starting to get some self-worth and self-esteem, it has to manifest itself in what I'm doing. Because if I'm still doing a job for $9,000 a year, that's what I was earning when I came into recovery, that ain't much fucking self-worth and self-esteem, is it? So I actually have to manifest my self-worth out there in the world. The funny thing is, when I do that, the world gives it to me. You know, I am a lecturer at college. I've never fucking taught at college in my life. Someone said to me, do you want to be a lecturer at college? I was like, are you crazy? And I said, yeah, okay. And they gave me this course to teach. They gave me two courses. I mean, it's bizarre. You know, and it's just like, so I'm a lecturer at college. I'm a good lecturer, actually. I'm really good at what I do. Fuck me. People pay to hear me teach them and impart my knowledge, and they say, oh, you're such a good lecturer. And today I can go, oh, thank you. I am, aren't I? See, I got it. By working my fucking nuts off and applying myself to recovery and doing the stuff that I didn't want to do, I've got it. I've got self-worth. I've got self-esteem. I've got a sense of who I am. I'm okay. I have a loving higher power in my life. That old fucking god of the cult is just like, you're gone. Because it's incompatible. I can't have self-worth and believe in that kind of God. You know, so really, it's my recovery was slow. Fucking slow. Because I had a lot of damage to undo. I had a lot of messages to undo. I had a lot of thought patterns to undo. And people held me. And people loved me. And people said, just be yourself. I mean, fucking hell, be yourself. Who am I? I don't know who I am. No good telling me to be my fucking self. If you could point out who I am, that'd be lovely. And you know, somewhere along the line, I learned I'm an amazing, worthwhile person. And I learned that I deserve respect. And you don't have to give it to me. You don't. You don't give it to me. You fuck off. No, it's true. Because I deserve it. If you ain't going to give me what I deserve, fuck off, sling your hook. I'm not interested. You know, I craved people that would abuse me. I craved it because I wanted to make them love me. And if I can make the abuser love me, then I must be something special. Well, now I am special. I don't need to fucking make the abuser love me. They can sling their hook. I ain't interested. You know, this program is absolutely fucking remarkable. It can take a damaged, broken, beaten, fucked up self-loathing addict. And it can turn them into a creature of beauty and power and wonder and life. And I owe it all to this program. I do. I owe it all to fucking Narcotics Anonymous. You know, when I see people, they come in, they do step one, step two, step three, they stop. They go, oh, I'm feeling better now. And it's like, yeah, you're feeling fucking better now because you're working the steps, you numpty. And then they stop. And it's okay, they stop. Slowly, imperceptibly, they start to slide backwards. Like Michael Jackson doing the moonwalk. Looks like you're going forward, you're going backwards. You know, a friend of mine died last year. I knew him for 6 years. He lied about this program. He said he'd stop using when he hadn't. He thought he could do it his way. He paid the ultimate surrender with his life. That's what happens. You're only fooling your fucking self. It made me so angry. But it could have been so different. And I loved him. And he died. And I don't like seeing people that I love die. It hurts me. And I have to just get on and do my recovery and shine the reflected light of you all back at you. Because it's not my fucking light. It's your light that you're seeing. You're just not able to sometimes see it yourselves. So you look at me and you say, fucking hell, he's amazing. No, I'm not fucking amazing. You're all amazing. I mean, I am amazing, but you're all amazing as well. And one day, if you work your recovery, work it. Because you're worth it. And it works if you work it. So one day, if you work your recovery, if you can't get that yet, that you're fucking an amazing power of your own, then one day you will. And you can pass that on to other people. And until that day, all you've got to do is keep coming back. I'm 17 and a half fucking years clean. All I've done is not use. You don't use for 17 and a half years. It just mounts up. That's all. It's no great thing. Just not using one day at a time. Thank you. Yeah.